Chapter 15. Leaving Dora. Refugees. Peterkin. Woody. 1. Breakfast was scrambled eggs, goose eggs by their size, and chunks of bread toasted over a new fire. There was no butter, but there was wonderful strawberry jam. When the meal was finished, I cinched up my pack and put it on. I clipped Radar's leash to her collar. I didn't want her chasing any giant rabbits into the woods and meeting this world's version of a Game of Thrones direwolf. "I'll come back," I told Dora, with more confidence than I felt. I almost added, "And Radar will be young again when I do," but thought that might jinx the deal. Also, I still found the idea of magical regeneration easy to hope for, but harder to believe, even in Empis. I think I can stay at Leah's uncle's house tonight, assuming he's not allergic to dogs or something, but I'd like to be there before dark. Thinking, it was hard not to, Wolfies. She nodded, but took my elbow and led me out the back door. The lines still crisscrossed the yard, but the shoes, slippers, and boots had been taken in, presumably so they wouldn't get dampened by the morning dew, which I hoped wasn't radioactive. We went around the side of the cottage, and there was the little cart I'd seen before. The sacks with the greenery poking out of the tops had been replaced by a package wrapped in burlap and tied with twine. Dora pointed at it, then at my mouth. She held a hand in front of her own mouth and opened and closed her partially melted fingers in a chewing gesture. It didn't take a rocket scientist to figure that one out. "Geez, no, I can't take your food, and I can't take your cart. Isn't that how you take the shoes you mend to your brother's store?" She pointed to Radar and made a number of limping steps, first toward the cart and then back to me. Then she pointed south, if I was right about my directions, that was, and walked her fingers in the air. The first part was easy. She was telling me that the cart was for Radar once she started to limp. I thought she was also telling me someone, probably her brother, would come for the shoes. Dora pointed to the cart, then made a little gray fist and hit me lightly in the chest 3 times. "You must." I saw her point. I had an elderly dog to care for and a long way to go. At the same time, I hated to take any more from her than I already had. "Are you sure?" She nodded. Then she held out her arms for a hug, which I was happy to give. She then dropped to her knees and hugged Radar. When she stood up again, she pointed first to the road, then to the crisscrossing lines, then to herself. "Get going. I have work to do." I made my own gesture, 2 thumbs up, then went to the cart and tossed my knapsack in with the supplies she'd packed, which, based on what I'd eaten in the cottage so far, would probably be far more tasty than Mr. Bowditch's sardines. I picked up the long handles and was delighted to find the cart weighed almost nothing, as if it had been made of this world's version of balsa wood. For all I knew, it was. Also, the wheels were well greased and didn't squeak, as the wheels of the young couple's cart had done. I thought pulling it would be hardly more difficult than pulling my little red wagon when I was 7. I turned it around and walked to the road, ducking under more lines as I went. Radar padded along beside me. When I reached what I was then thinking of as the city road, there wasn't a yellow brick in sight, so that name was out, I turned back. Dora was standing at the side of her cottage, with her hands clasped between her breasts. When she saw me looking, she raised them to her mouth and then opened them toward me. I dropped the handles of the cart long enough to copy her gesture, then set out on my way. Here's something I learned in Empis. Good people shine brighter in dark times. Help her too, I thought. Help Dora too. 2. We walked up hill and down dale, as one of those old stories might say. Crickets chirred and birds sang. The poppies on our left occasionally gave way to tilled fields, where I saw gray men and women, not a lot, working. They saw me and stopped what they were doing until I went by. I waved, but only one of them, a woman wearing a big straw hat, waved back. There were other fields lying fallow and forgotten. Weeds sprouted among the growing vegetables along with bright scarves of poppies, which I thought would eventually take over. On the right, the woods continued. There were a few farmhouses, but most of them were deserted. Twice, rabbits as big as small dogs hopped across the path. Radar looked at them with interest but showed no inclination to chase them, so I unclipped her lead and tossed it in the cart. "Don't disappoint me, girl." After an hour or so, I stopped to untie the good-sized bundle of food Dora had packed for me. There were molasses cookies among the other goodies. No chocolate in those, so I gave one to Radar, who snarked it up. There were also three long glass jars wrapped in clean rags. Two were filled with water, and one contained what looked like tea. I drank some water and gave some to Radar in a pottery cup my friend had also packed. She lapped it up eagerly. As I finished repacking, I saw three people trudging down the road toward me. The two men were just beginning to turn gray, but the woman walking between them was as dark as a summer thundercloud. One of her eyes was pulled up in a slit that stretched all the way to her temple, an awful thing to look at. Except for a single blue gleam of iris like a shard of sapphire, the other was buried in a lump of gray flesh. She was wearing a filthy dress that bulged out in what could only be a late-stage pregnancy. She held a bundle wrapped in a filthy blanket. One of the men was wearing a pair of boots with buckles on the sides. They reminded me of the one I'd seen hanging on a line in Dora's backyard when I made my first visit. The other man wore sandals. The woman's feet were bare, and she looked exhausted. They saw Radar sitting in the road and paused.
"Don't worry," I called. "She won't bite you."
They came on slowly, then stopped again. It was the holstered gun they were looking at now, so I raised my hands, palms out. They began walking again, but shying way over to the left side of the road, looking at Radar, looking at me, then back to Radar again.
"We mean you no harm," I said.
The men were skinny and tired looking. The woman looked flat out exhausted.
"Hold on a minute," I said.
In case they didn't understand me, I held up my hands in a policeman's stop gesture.
"Please."
They stopped. It was a mighty sad-looking trio. Up close, I could see that the men's mouths were beginning to turn up. Soon they would be crescents that hardly moved, like Dora's. They huddled next to the woman when I reached into my pocket, and she pulled her bundle to her breasts. I got one of the little leather shoes and held it out to her.
"Take it, please."
She reached out, hesitantly, then snatched it from my hand as if she expected me to grab her. When she did, the blanket fell away from her bundle and I saw a dead baby, maybe a year or a year and a half old. It was as gray as the lid of my mother's coffin. Soon, this poor woman would have another to replace it, and probably that one would die too. If the woman didn't die first, that was, or during her labor.
"Do you understand me?"
"We understand," said the man in the boots. His voice was grating, but otherwise normal enough. "What would you have with us, stranger, if not our lives, for we have nothing else?"
No, of course they didn't. If a person had done this or caused it to be done, that person belonged in hell. The deepest pit thereof. "I can't give you my cart or my food, for I have far to go and my dog is old. But if you walk another three..." I tried to say miles, but the word wouldn't come. I started again. "If you walk until maybe midday, you'll see the sign of the red shoe. The lady who lives in that place will let you rest and may give you food and drink." That wasn't exactly a promise. My dad was fond of pointing out what he called weasel words in TV commercials for wonder drugs. And I knew Dora couldn't feed and water every group of refugees that passed her cottage. But I thought when she saw the state of the woman and the horrific bundle she carried, that she would be moved to help these three. Meanwhile, the man in the sandals was examining the little leather shoe. He asked what it was for. Further on, past the woman I told you about, is a store where you can give that token for a pair of shoes.
Is there burying? This was the man in the boots. For my son needs a burying.
I don't know. I'm a stranger here. Ask at the sign of the red shoe, or at the farm of the goose girl farther on. Madam, I'm sorry for your loss.
He was a good boy,
she said, looking down at her dead child.
My Tam was a good boy. He was fine when he was born, rosy as the dawn. But then the gray fell on him. Walk your way, sir, and we'll walk ours.
Wait a minute, please. I opened my pack, rummaged, and found 2 cans of King Oscar sardines. I held them out. They shied away from them. No, it's all right. It's food. Sardines? Little fish. You pull the ring in the top to get them, see? I tapped it. The 2 men looked at each other, then shook their heads. They wanted nothing to do with pull-top cans, it seemed, and the woman seemed to have disconnected from the conversation entirely.
We need to get on, said the one in the sandals.
As for you, young man, you are going the wrong way.
It's the way I have to go, I said. He looked me straight in the eye and said,
That way is death.
They went on, trudging up dust from the city road, the woman carrying her awful burden. Why did one of the men not take it from her? I was just a kid, but I thought I knew the answer to that. He was hers, her Tam, and his body was hers to carry for as long as she could carry it. 3. I felt stupid about not offering them the rest of the cookies, and selfish about keeping the cart. Until radar fell behind, that was. I was too deep in my own thoughts to notice when that happened, and you may be surprised, or not, to learn those thoughts had little to do with Sandalman's doomish parting words. The idea that I could get killed going in the direction of the city came as no great surprise to me. Mr. Bowditch, Dora, and Leah had all made that clear in their various ways. But when you're a kid, it's easy to believe that you will be the exception, the one who wins through and gets the laurels. After all, who had scored the winning touchdown in the Turkey Bowl? Who had disarmed Christopher Pauly? I was at an age when it's possible to believe that fast reflexes and reasonable care can surmount most obstacles. I was thinking about the language we were speaking. What I heard wasn't exactly colloquial American English, but it wasn't archaic either. There were no these and thous and may it please yous. Nor was it the English English of all those IMAX fantasy films where all the hobbits and elves and wizards sound like members of parliament. It was the sort of English you'd expect to read in a slightly modernized fairy tale. Then there was me. I had said I couldn't give them my cart, for I had far to go and my dog was old. If I'd been talking to someone in Sentry, I would have said, because I have a long way to go. I had spoken of the sign of the red shoe, instead of saying, it's a little house with a shoe sign in front. And I hadn't called the pregnant woman ma'am, as I would have in my hometown. I had called her madam. And it had come out of my mouth sounding perfectly okay. I thought again of the funnel filling with stars. I thought I was one of those stars now. I thought I was becoming part of the story. I looked for radar, and she wasn't there, which gave me a nasty jolt. I lowered the poles of the wagon to the road and looked behind me. She was 20 yards back, limping along as fast as she could with her tongue lolling from the side of her mouth.
Jesus, girl, I'm sorry.
I carried her to the cart, making sure to lace my hands under her belly and stay away from those painful back legs. I gave her another drink from her cup, tilting it so she could get as much as she wanted, then scratched behind her ears.
Why didn't you say something?
Well, duh. It wasn't that kind of fairy tale. 4. We walked on, hill and dale, dale and hill. We saw more refugees. Some shrank away, but two men walking together stopped and stood on their toes to peer into the cart and see what was there. Radar growled at them, but given her patchy fur and white muzzle, I doubt if she scared them much. The gun on my hip was different. They had shoes, so I didn't give out my last token. I don't think I would have suggested they stop at Dora's even if they'd been barefoot. I didn't give them any of my food, either. There were fields they could forage in if they were hungry enough.
If it's seafront you're going for, turn around, boy. The Greys come there too.
Thanks for the... Info wouldn't come out. Thanks for telling me.
I picked up the cart's poles, but kept an eye on them to make sure they kept going. Around noon, we came to a marshy place that had overspread the road and turned it muddy. I bent my back and pulled the cart faster until we were through it, not wanting to get stuck. The cart wasn't much heavier with Radar on board, which told me more than I really wanted to know. Once we were back on dry ground again, I pulled over in the shade of what looked like one of the oaks in Kavanaugh Park. There was fried rabbit meat in one of the little bundles Dora had packed, and I shared it, even Stephen, with Radar, or tried to. She ate two chunks, but dropped the third between her front paws and looked at me, apologetically. Even in the shade, I could see that her eyes were growing rheumy again. It crossed my mind that she had caught whatever was going around, the gray, but I rejected the idea. It was age, pure and simple. It was hard to tell how much time she had left, but I didn't think it was a lot. While we ate, more giant-sized rabbits went lolloping across the road. Then a couple of crickets that were about double the size of the ones I was used to, hopping nimbly along on their back legs. I was amazed at how much air they could get between jumps. A hawk, normal-sized, swooped down and tried to grab one of them, but the cricket took evasive action and was soon out of sight in the grass and weeds that bordered the forest. Radar watched this parade of wildlife with interest, but without getting to her feet, let alone giving chase. I drank some of the tea, which was sugary and delicious. I had to stop myself after a few swallows. God knew when there might be more. Come on, girl. Want to get to the uncle's. The idea of camping out near those woods doesn't thrill me. I picked her up, then paused. Written on the oak in fading red paint were two letters, A, B. Knowing Mr. Bowditch had been here before me made me feel better. It was as if he wasn't entirely gone. 5. Mid-afternoon. The day was warm enough for me to have worked up a good sweat. We hadn't seen any refugees for a while, but as we reached the foot of a rise, long but with a slope too mild to actually be called a hill, I heard scrambling from behind me. Radar had come to the front of the cart. She was sitting with her paws on the front and her ears up. I stopped and heard something ahead that might have been faint, chuffing laughter. I started forward again, but stopped short of the crest, listening.
How do you like that, sweetie? Does it tickle?
It was a high, fluting voice that cracked on sweetie and tickle. Otherwise, it was weirdly familiar. And after a moment, I realized why. It sounded like Christopher Pauly. I knew it couldn't be, but it sure did. I started forward again, stopping as soon as I could see into the dip on the other side of the rise. I had seen some strange things in this other world, but nothing so strange as a child sitting in the dust with a hand clamped around the back legs of a cricket. It was the biggest I'd seen so far, and red instead of black. In his other hand, the child held what looked like a dagger with a short blade and a cracked haft held together with string. He was too absorbed in what he was doing to see us. He stuck the cricket in its belly, producing a tiny spurt of blood. Until then, I didn't know crickets could bleed. There were other droplets in the dirt, which suggested the kid had been at this nasty business for some time.
Like that, honey?
The cricket lunged, but with its back legs hobbled, the kid pulled it back easily.
How about a little in your...
Radar barked. The kid looked around, not losing his hold on the big cricket's back legs, and I saw he wasn't a kid, but a dwarf. An old, white hair straggled down his cheeks in clumps. His face was lined, the ones bracketing his mouth so deep that he looked like the kind of ventriloquist's dummy Leah could have used, if she wasn't pretending her horse could talk, that was. His face wasn't doing that melting thing, but his skin was the color of clay. And he still reminded me of Polly, partly because he was small, but mostly because of the slyness in his face. Given that sly look, added to what he was doing, I could easily imagine him capable of murdering a limping old jeweler.
Who are you?
No fear, because I was at some distance and silhouetted against the sky. He hadn't seen the gun yet. What are you doing?
I caught this fella. It was quick, but old Peterkin was quicker. I'm trying to see if it feels pain. God knows I do.
He prinked the cricket again, this time between two plates of his carapace. The red cricket bled and struggled. I started pulling the cart down the hill. Radar gave another bark. She was still standing with her legs braced on the board at its front.
Curb your dog, sonny. I would if I was you. If she comes near me, I'll cut his throat.
I set down the poles and drew Mr. Bowditch's 45 from the holster for the first time.
You won't cut her or me. Stop doing that. Let it go.
The dwarf, Peterkin, regarded the gun with puzzlement rather than fright.
Now why would you want me to do that? I'm only having a little fun in a world where there's hardly any left.
You're torturing it.
Peterkin looked amazed.
Torture, you say? Torture? Oh, you idiot, it's a damn insect. You can't torture an insect. And why would you care?
I cared because watching him hold the thing's jumping legs, its only means of escape, while he poked it again and again, was ugly and cruel.
I won't tell you twice.
He laughed, and he even sounded a little like Polly, with his ha-ha interjections.
Shoot me over an insect. I don't think so.
I aimed high and to the left and pulled the trigger. The report was much louder than it had been from inside Mr. Bowditch's shed. Radar barked. The dwarf jerked in surprise and let go of the cricket. It hopped away into the grass, but crookedly. The damned little man had lamed it. Only an insect, but that didn't make what this Peterkin had been doing right. And how many red crickets had I seen? Only this one. They were probably as rare as albino deer. The dwarf got up and dusted off the seat of his bright green breeches. He swept the ragged clumps of his white hair back, like a concert pianist getting ready to play his big number. Leaden skin or no leaden skin, he seemed lively enough. Lively as a cricket, so to speak. And while he'd never sing on American Idol, he had a lot more voice than most people I'd met in the last 24 hours, and his face was all present and accounted for. Other than being a dwarf,
never call them midgets. They hate it, my dad told me once.
And having a shitty complexion that could have used a shot of Otezla, he seemed pretty much okay.
I see that you're an irritable boy,
he said, looking at me with disgust and maybe, I hope so, just a trace of fear.
So why don't I go my way and you go yours?
That sounds good. But I want to ask you something before we part company. How come your face is more or less normal and so many other folks seem to be getting uglier all the time?
Not that he was any poster boy himself, and I'm sure the question was on the rude side, but if you can't be rude to a guy you catch torturing a giant cricket, who can you be rude to?
Maybe because the gods, if you believe in them, already played a trick on me. How would a big fellow like you know what it's like to be a little fellow Like me, not even 24 hands from ground to crown.
A whining note had come into his voice, the tone of someone who had, in AA lingo, a ring around his ass from sitting on the pity pot. I put my thumb and finger together and rubbed. See this? It's the world's smallest violin playing, "My Heart Pumps Purple Piss for You." Piss came out perfectly, I noted. He frowned.
Hey?
Never mind. My little joke. Trying to tickle you.
I'll go on now, if you don't mind.
Do that. But my dog and I would feel better if you'd put that knife away before you do.
You think just because you're one of the whole ones, you're better than me,
the little man said.
You'll see what they do to ones like you if they catch you.
Who will?
The night soldiers.
Who are they? And what do they do to ones like me? He sneered.
Never mind. I just hope you can battle. But I doubt it. You look strong on the outside, but I think you're soft on the inside. That's the way folks are when they don't have to struggle. Haven't missed many meals, have you, young sir?
You're still holding the knife, Mr. Peterkin. Put it away, or I might decide to make you throw it away. The dwarf jammed the knife into his waistband, and I sort of hoped he'd give himself a cut doing it. The nastier the better, which was a mean thought. Then I had a meaner one. Suppose I reached out and grabbed the hand that had held the red cricket's legs together and snapped it, as I had Polly's. As sort of an object lesson, this is what it feels like. I could tell you it wasn't a serious thought, but I think it was. It was too easy to see him using a chokehold on Radar while he used his dagger on her. Prink, prink, prink. He never could have done it when she was in her prime, but her prime had been years ago. But I let him pass. He looked back once before he went over the rise, and that look didn't say, "Well met on the city road, young stranger." That look said, "Don't let me catch you sleeping." No chance of that. He was on his way to wherever the rest of the refugees were going, but it wasn't until after he was gone that it occurred to me that I really should have made him drop the knife and leave it behind. 6. By late afternoon, there were no more tilled fields and no more farms that looked like they were working at all. There were no more refugees either, although at one deserted farm I saw handcarts filled with possessions in the overgrown front yard and thin smoke rising from the chimney. Probably a party that had decided to get undercover before the wolfies began to howl, I thought. If I didn't come to the house of Leah's uncle soon, it would be wise of me to do the same. I had Mr. Bowditch's revolver and Polly's .22 pop gun, but wolves tended to travel in packs, and they could be as big as moose for all I knew. Also, my arms, shoulders, and back were getting tired. The cart was light, and at least there had been no more mud holes to power through, but I'd pulled it a long way since leaving Dora's. I saw Mr. Bowditch's initials, his original initials, A.B., 3 more times. Twice on trees overhanging the road, and the last time on a huge rock outcropping. By then the blob of sun had dropped behind the trees, and shadows were engulfing the land. I hadn't seen any dwellings for some time, and I was starting to worry that full dark might catch us still on the road. I really didn't want that. As sophomores, we had been tasked to memorize at least 16 lines of a poem. Ms. Debbins had given us 24 poems to choose from. I had picked something from The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, and wished now I had chosen anything else because the lines were just too apt. "Like one that on a lonesome road doth walk in fear and dread, and having once turned round, walks on, and turns no more his head. Because he knows a frightful fiend doth close behind him tread." I finished aloud. I put down the poles of the cart and rolled my shoulders while I looked at A.B. on the rock. Mr. Bowditch had really knocked himself out on that one. The letters were 3 feet high.
Raids, you'd bark to alert me if you saw a frightful fiend behind us, right?
She was fast asleep in the cart. No help from frightful fiends there. I thought about getting a drink of water. It was pretty dry, and decided it could wait. I wanted to push on while there was still some daylight left. I picked up the poles and got walking, thinking that even a woodshed would look good at this point. The road curved around the outcrop, then ran straight into the gathering twilight. And up ahead, surely no more than a mile, I could see the lighted windows of a house. As I drew closer, I saw a lantern hanging from a post out front. I could just make out that the road forked 60 or 70 yards beyond the house, which was indeed made of brick, like that of the industrious little pig in the story. A stone-flagged path led up to the front door, but before I used it, I stopped to examine the lantern, which gave off a harsh white light that was hard to look at up close. I'd seen one like it before, in Mr. Bowditch's basement, and didn't have to check the base to know it was a Coleman, available at any American hardware store. I guessed that the lantern, like Dora's sewing machine, had been a gift from Mr. Bowditch.
"A coward gives presents," he'd said.
In the center of the door was a gilded knocker in the shape of a fist. I lowered the cart and heard a scrabbling as Radar made her way down its sloping floor to join me. I was reaching for the knocker when the door opened. Standing there was a man, almost as tall as I was, but much thinner, almost gaunt. Because he was backlit by a blaze in the fireplace, I couldn't make out his features, just the cat on his shoulder and a fine gauze of white hair standing up around his otherwise bald head. When he spoke, it was again hard to believe that I hadn't stepped into a storybook and become one of the characters.
"Hello, young prince. I've been expecting you. You are welcome here. Come in."
7. I realized I'd left Radar's leash in the cart.
I think I should probably get my dog's lead first, sir. I don't know how she does with cats.
"She'll be fine," the old man said. "But if you have food, I suggest you bring it in. If you don't want to find it gone in the morning, that is."
I went back and got Dora's care package and my pack, plus the leash, just in case. The man of the house stepped aside and made a little bow.
"Come on, Raids, but be good. I'm counting on you."
Radar followed me into a neat sitting room with a rag rug on a hardwood floor. There were 2 easy chairs close to the fire. A book had been laid open on the arm of one. There were a few others on a shelf nearby. The other side of the room was a narrow little kitchen like a ship's galley. On the table, there was bread, cheese, cold chicken, and a bowl of what I was quite sure was cranberry jelly. Also a pottery pitcher. My stomach made a loud rumbling sound. The man laughed.
"I heard that. There's an old saying, youth must be served. To which might be appended, and often."
There were 2 places set, and a bowl on the floor by one of the chairs, from which Radar was already drinking noisily.
"You knew I was coming, didn't you? How did you know?"
"Do you know the name we prefer not to speak?"
I nodded. In stories like the one I seem to have entered, there's often a name that must not be spoken, lest evil awake.
"He hasn't taken everything from us. You saw that my niece was able to speak to you, yes?"
"Through her horse."
"Falada. Yes. Leah also speaks to me, young prince, although rarely. When she does, her communications aren't always clear, and throwing her thoughts tires her even more than throwing her voice. We have many things to discuss, but first we'll eat. Come."
"He's talking about telepathy," I thought.
It must be, because she surely didn't phone him or shoot him a text.
Why do you call me Young Prince?
He shrugged. The cat bobbed on his shoulder.
A form of familiar address, that's all. Very old-fashioned. Someday, perhaps, a real prince will come, but from the sound of your voice it isn't you. You're very young.
He smiled and turned toward the galley. The firelight shone fully on his face for the first time, but I think I knew already simply by the way he held out one hand before him as he walked, testing the air for obstacles. He was blind. 8. When he sat, the cat jumped to the floor. Its fur was a luxuriant smoky brown. It approached Radar, and I got ready to grab her collar if she lunged at it. She didn't, just lowered her head and sniffed at the cat's nose. Then she lay down. The cat paced in front of her like an officer inspecting a soldier on parade and finding her sloppy, then sashayed to the living room. She jumped into the chair with the book on its arm and curled up.
My name is Charles Reed. Charlie, did Leah tell you that?
No, it doesn't work that way. It's more like having an intuition. It's nice to meet you, Prince Charlie.
Now that the light was on his face, I could see his eyes were as gone as Leah's mouth, with only long-heeled scars to mark where they had been.
My name is Stephen Woodley. I once had a title, Prince Regent, as a matter of fact. But those days are gone. Call me Woody, if you like. For we live near the woods, don't we? I and Catriona.
That's your cat?
Yes. And I believe your dog is Raymar? Something like that, surely. I can't remember.
Radar. She was Mr. Bowditch's? He died.
Ah, I'm sorry to hear that.
And he looked sorry, but not really surprised.
How well did you know him, sir?
Woody, please. We passed the time, as you and I will, Charlie, I hope. But we should eat first, because it's a long way you've come today, I think.
Can I ask one question first?
He smiled broadly, turning his face into a river of wrinkles.
If you want to know how old I am, I really can't remember. Sometimes I think I was old when the world was young.
It's not that. I saw the book and wondered if you're, you know.
How I read if I'm blind. Have a look. Meanwhile, would you like a leg or a breast?
Breast, please.
He began serving out and must have been used to doing it in the dark for a long time because there was no hesitation in his movements. I got up and went to his chair. Catriona looked up at me with wise green eyes. The book was an old one with a cover showing bats flying against a full moon. The Black Angel by Cornell Woolrich. It could have come from one of the stacks in Mr. Bowditch's bedroom. Except when I picked it up and looked at where Woody had left off, I saw no words, only little groups of dots. I put it back and returned to the table.
You read Braille,
I said, thinking, the language in books must change too, get translated. How weird is that?
I do. Adrian brought me a lesson book and showed me the letters. Once I had those, I was able to teach myself. He brought me other books in Braille from time to time. He was partial to fanciful stories, like the one I was reading while I waited for your arrival. Dangerous men and damsels in distress, living in a world far different from this one.
He shook his head and laughed, as if reading fiction were a frivolous pursuit, maybe even crazy. His cheeks were rosy from having sat close to the fire, and I saw no trace of gray in them. He was whole, yet he wasn't. Neither was his niece. He had no eyes to see with, and she had no mouth to speak with, only a sore she opened with her fingernail to take whatever poor nourishment she could. Talk about a damsel in distress.
Come, sit.
I came to the table. Outside, a wolf howled, so the moons, must have appeared. But we were safe in this house of bricks. If a wolfie came down the chimney, it would roast its furry assie in the fire. This whole world seems fanciful to me, I said.
Stay here long enough, and it will be yours that seems like make-believe. Now eat, Charlie.
9. The food was delicious. I asked for seconds, then thirds. I felt sort of guilty about it, but it had been a long day, and I'd pulled that cart 18 or 20 miles. Woody ate sparingly, nothing but a drumstick and a little of the cranberry jelly. I felt more guilty when I saw that. I remembered my mother delivering me to a sleepover at Andy Chen's house, and Mom telling Andy's mom that I had a hollow leg and would eat them out of house and home if she let me. I asked Woody where he got his supplies.
Seafront. There are some there who still remember such as we, or such as we were, and pay tribute. The gray has come there now. People are leaving. You probably met some on the road.
I did, I said, and told him about Peterkin.
A red cricket, you say? There are legends, but never mind. Glad you put a stop to it. Maybe you're a prince after all. Blonde hair, blue eyes?
He was teasing. Nope, both brown.
So, not a prince, and certainly not the prince.
Who is the prince?
Just another legend. This is a world of stories and legends, as is yours. As for food, I used to get more viands than I could eat from the people of Seafront, although usually fish rather than meat, as you might expect from the name. It was a long time before the gray came to that part of the world. How long, I can't say. The days blend together when one is always in the dark.
He said that without self-pity, just stating a fact.
I believe Seafront may have been spared for a while because they are on a narrow peninsula where the wind always blows, but no one knows for sure. Last year, Charlie, you would have met scores of people on the King's Road. Now the flood is ebbing.
The King's Road, that's what you call it?
Yes, but once it passes the fork, it's Kingdom Road. If you were to choose to go left at the fork, you would be on Seafront Road.
Where are they going? I mean after Dora's house and Leah's farm and the store Dora's brother keeps. Woody looked surprised.
Does he still keep it? I'm amazed. What does he have to sell, I wonder?
I don't know. I just know he gives them new shoes to replace their broken ones. Woody laughed, delighted.
Dora and James up to their old tricks. The answer to your question is, I don't know, and I'm sure they don't. Just away. Away, away, away.
The wolves had been silent, but now they began howling again. It sounded like dozens of them, and I was very glad I'd reached Woody's house of bricks when I had. Radar whined. I stroked her head. The moons must be out.
According to Adrian, there's only one in your make-believe kingdom. As one of the characters in Mr. Cornell Woolrich's book says, you was robbed. Would you like a slice of cake, Charlie? I fear you may find it a trifle stale.
Cake would be wonderful. Do you want me to get it?
Not at all. after all these years here. It's quite the cozy den for an exile, don't you think? I know my way around very well. It's on a shelf in the pantry. Sit still, I'll be back in 2 ticks.
While he got the cake, I helped myself to more lemonade from the pitcher. Lemonade seemed to be the go-to drink in Empus. He brought a big piece of chocolate cake for me and a sliver for himself. It made the cake we got in the high school caf look pretty lame. I didn't think it was stale at all, just a little stiff around the edges. The wolves abruptly quit, again making me think of someone pulling a plug on an amp that had been turned up to 11. It occurred to me that no one in this world would get that reference to Spinal Tap or any other movie. I guess the clouds are back, I said. They go away, right? He shook his head slowly.
Not since he came. It rains here, Prince Charlie, but it almost never shines.
Jesus, I said.
Another prince,
Woody replied, once again with the broad smile.
Of peace, according to the Braille Bible Adrian brought me. Are you replete? That means...
I know what it means, and I sure am. He stood.
Then come, sit by the fire. We need to talk.
I followed him to the 2 chairs in his little parlor. Radar followed. Woody felt for Catriona, found her, and picked her up. She lay over his hands like a fur stole until he set her on the floor. There she spared a haughty glance for my dog, gave a dismissive flick of her tail, and strolled away. Radar lay down between the 2 chairs. I had given her a share of my chicken, but she ate only a little of it. Now she looked into the fire, as if deciphering its secrets. I thought about asking Woody what he'd do for supplies now that the town of Seafront had joined the evacuation, but decided not to. I was afraid he'd tell me he had no idea. I want to thank you for the meal. He waved this away. You're probably wondering what I'm doing here.
Not at all.
He reached down and stroked Radar's back. Then he turned the scars that had been his eyes to me.
Your dog is dying, and there's no time to waste if you intend to accomplish what you came for.
10. Full of food, safe in the house of bricks with the wolves silent for the time being and the fireplace warming me, I had been relaxing, feeling content. But when he said Raids was dying, I sat up straight. Not necessarily. She's old and she's got arthritis in her hips, but she's not. I thought of the vet's assistant saying she'd be surprised if Radar lived until Halloween, and fell silent.
I'm blind, but my other senses work quite well for an old fellow.
His voice was kind, and that made it dreadful.
In fact, my ears have grown more acute than ever. I had horses and dogs in the palace. As a boy and a young man, I was always out with them and loved them all well. I know how they sound when they're rounding the final turn for home. Listen. Close your eyes and listen.
I did as he said. I could hear an occasional pop from the fireplace. Somewhere a clock was ticking. A breeze had picked up outside. And I could hear Radar. The wheeze each time she inhaled. The rattle each time she exhaled.
You came to put her on the sundial.
Yes. And there's gold. Little gold pellets, kind of like birdshot. I don't need that now, but Mr. Bowditch said later on I...
Never mind the gold. Just getting to the sundial and using it is a mission dangerous enough for such a young prince as yourself. It risks Hannah. She wasn't there in Bowditch's time. You may find your way past her if you're careful and lucky. Luck can't be discounted in such a business. As for the gold...
He shook his head.
That's riskier yet. It's good you don't need it now.
Hannah. I filed the name away for later. There was something else I was immediately curious about. Why are you all right? Except for being blind, I mean. I wished I could take it back as soon as the words were out of my mouth. Sorry, that didn't come out right. He smiled.
No apology necessary. Given a choice between being blind and having the gray, I'd choose blindness every time. I have adjusted quite well. Thanks to Adrian, I even have make-believe stories to read. The gray is slow death. It becomes harder and harder to breathe. The face is swallowed up by useless flesh. The body closes up.
He raised one of his hands and made a fist.
Like this.
Will that happen to Dora? He nodded, but he didn't have to. It was a child's question. How long does she have? Woody shook his head.
Impossible to say. It's slow, and not the same for everyone, but it's relentless. That's the horror of it.
What if she left? Went to wherever the others are going?
I don't think she'd go. And I don't think it matters. Once it comes, there's no outrunning it. Like the wasting disease. Is that what killed Adrian?
I assumed he was talking about cancer.
No, he had a heart attack. Ah, a little pain, then gone. Better than the gray. As to your question, once upon a time, Adrian said that's how many stories start in the world he came from.
Yeah, it is. And things I've seen over here are like those stories.
As are things where you came from, I'm sure. It's all stories, Prince Charlie.
The wolves began to howl. Woody fingered his braille book, then closed it and put it on a small table beside his chair. I wondered how he would find his place again. Catriona returned, jumped into his lap, and began to purr.
Once upon a time, in the land of Empis and the city of Lilimar, where you are bound, there was a royal family, going back thousands of years. Most, not all, but most, ruled wisely and well. But when the terrible time came, almost all of that family were killed. Slaughtered.
Leah told me some of that. You know, through Falada. She said her mother and father were dead. They were the king and queen, right? Because she said she was a princess, the littlest of them all. He smiled.
Yes, indeed. The littlest of them all. She told you her sisters were slain?
Yes.
What of her brothers?
That they were killed too. He sighed and stroked his cat and looked at the fire. I'm sure he could feel its heat, and I wondered if he could see it a little too. The way you can look at the sun with your eyes closed and see redness as your blood lights up. He opened his mouth as if to say something, then closed it again and gave his head a little shake. The wolves sounded really close. Then they stopped. The way that happened all at once was eerie.
It was a purge. You know what that means?
Yes.
But some few of us survived. We escaped the city, and Hannah won't leave it because she is an outcast from her own land. Far to the north. There were 8 of us who made it through the main gate. We would have been 9, but my nephew, Aloysius.
Woody gave his head another shake.
8 of us escaped death in the city. And our blood protects us from the gray. but another curse followed us. Can you guess?
I could. Each of you lost one of your senses.
Yes. Leah can eat, but it's painful for her to do so, as you may have seen.
I nodded, although he couldn't see it.
She can hardly taste what she eats. And, as you saw, she can't speak except through Falada. She's convinced that he is fooled by that, if he listens. I don't know. Maybe she's right. Maybe he hears and it amuses him.
When you say he, I stopped there. Woody grasped my shirt and pulled. I leaned toward him. He put his lips to my ear and whispered. I expected Gogmagog, but that wasn't what he said. What he said was,
"Flight killer."
11.
He could send assassins against us, but he doesn't. He lets us live, those of us who remain. And living is punishment enough. Aloysius, as I said, never made it out of the city. Ellen, Warner, and Greta have taken their lives. I believe Yolanda still lives, but she wanders, insane. Like me, she's blind, living for the most part on the kindness of strangers. I feed her when she comes, and agree with the gibberish she speaks. These are nieces, nephews, and cousins, you understand. The close blood. Do you follow?
Yes. I did, more or less.
Burton has become an anchorite, living deep in the woods and constantly praying for Empus's deliverance with hands he can't feel when he presses them together. He can't feel wounds unless he sees blood. He eats, but he has no sense of whether his stomach is full or empty.
My God, I said. I had thought being blind must be the worst, but it wasn't.
The wolves leave Burton alone. At least they did. It's been 2 years or more since he came here. He may be dead too. My little party left in a farrier's wagon, with me, not yet blind as you see me now, standing up and snapping a whip over a team of 6 horses that were crazed with fear. With me were my cousin Claudia, my nephew Aloysius, and my niece Leah. We flew like the wind, Charlie, the wagon's iron-bound wheels striking up sparks from the cobblestones and actually flying in the air for 10 feet or more from the top of the Rumpa Bridge. I thought the wagon might turn over or break apart when we came down, but it was sturdy made and held together. We could hear Hannah roaring from behind us, roaring like a storm coming ever closer. I can still hear those roars. I lashed the horses, and they ran as if hell was after them. As it was, Aloysius looked back just before we reached the gate, and Hannah swatted his head from his shoulders. I didn't see that. All my attention was fixed ahead, but Claudia saw. Leah didn't, thank God, she was wrapped in a blanket. The next swipe of Hannah's hand tore off the back of the wagon. I could smell her breath. Can smell it still. Rotted fish and meat and the reek of her sweat. We got through the gate just in time. She roared when she saw we had escaped her. The hate and frustration in that sound. Yes. I hear it still.
He stopped and wiped his mouth. His hand shook when he did it. I had never seen PTSD outside of movies like The Hurt Locker, but I was seeing it now. I don't know how long ago all that had happened, but the horror was still with him and still fresh. I didn't like being responsible for making him remember that time and speak of it, but I needed to know what I was getting into.
Charlie, if you go into my pantry, you'll find a bottle of blackberry wine in the cold cupboard. I would like a small glass, if you don't mind. Have one yourself if you'd like.
I found the bottle and poured him a glass. The smell of fermented blackberries was strong enough to kill any desire I might have had to pour my own glass, even without the healthy wariness I had for alcohol on account of my father. So I helped myself to more lemonade instead. He drank two big swallows, most of what was in the glass, and heaved a sigh.
That's better. These memories are sad and painful. It's growing late and you must be tired, so it's time to talk about what you must do to save your friend. If you still intend to go ahead, that is.
I do.
You'd risk your life and sanity for the dog.
She's all I have left of Mr. Bowditch. I hesitated, then gave him the rest of it. And I love her.
Very well. I understand love. Here is what you must do. Listen carefully. Another day's walk will take you to the house of my cousin Claudia, if you move along briskly, that is. When you get there...
I listened carefully, as if my life depended on it. The wolves howling outside suggested very strongly that it did. 12. Woody's toilet was an outhouse connected to his bedroom by a short board passage. As I walked that passage, holding a lantern, the old-fashioned kind, not a Coleman, something hit the wall with a hard thump. Something hungry, I assumed. I dry-brushed my teeth and used the facility. I hoped Raids could hold her water until morning, because no way was I going to take her out until then. I didn't have to sleep by the fire here, because there was a second bedroom. The small bed had a frilly coverlet, embroidered with butterflies that just about had to be Dora's work, and the walls were painted pink. Woody told me that both Leah and Claudia had used it on occasion, Leah not for many years.
"Here they are as they were," he said.
He reached out carefully and took a small oval painting in a gilt frame from a shelf. I saw a teenage girl and a young woman. Both were gorgeous. They stood with their arms around each other in front of a fountain. They wore pretty dresses and bits of lace over their dressed hair. Leah had a mouth to smile with. And yes, they looked like royalty. I pointed to the girl. "This was Leah? Before..."
"Yes."
Woody put the picture back in its place just as carefully.
"Before. What happened to us happened not too long after we fled the city. An act of pure, spiteful vengeance. They were beautiful, wouldn't you say?"
"I would." I kept looking at the smiling younger girl and thought that Leah's curse was twice as terrible as Woody's blindness. "Whose vengeance?" He shook his head.
"I don't want to talk of it. I only wish I could see that picture again. But wishes are like beauty, vain things. Sleep well, Charlie. You must be on your way early if you are to reach Claudia's before sundown tomorrow. She may tell you more. And if you wake in the night, or if your dog wakes you, don't go out. Not for anything."
"I totally understand that."
"Good. I'm delighted to have made your acquaintance, young prince. Any friend of Adrian's is, as they say, a friend of mine.
He left, walking confidently, but with one hand held out before him, as must have been second nature to him after all the years he'd spent in darkness. How many had that been, I wondered? How long since the rise of Gog Magog and the purge that had decimated his family? Who or what was Flight Killer? How long since Leah had been a girl with a smiling mouth who took eating for granted? Were the years even the same here? Stephen Woodley was Woody, like the cowboy in Toy Story. That was probably just a coincidence, but I didn't think the wolves and the House of Bricks were. Then there was that thing he'd said about the Rumpa Bridge. My mother had died on the bridge over the Little Rumpel, and a Rumpelstiltskin kind of guy had almost killed me. Was I supposed to believe those things coincidences? Radar was sleeping beside my bed, and now that Woody had called my attention to the rattle and wheeze of her breathing, I couldn't unhear it. I thought either that or the sporadic howling of the wolves would keep me awake, but I had come a long way and pulling a cart behind me. I didn't last long. I had no dreams and didn't come to until early the next morning with Woody shaking my shoulder.
"Wake up, Charlie. I've made us breakfast, and you must be on your way as soon as you've eaten."
13. There was a bowl heaped with scrambled eggs and a bowl similarly heaped with smoking sausages. Woody ate a little, Radar ate a little, and I took care of the rest myself.
"I've put your possessions in Dora's cart and added something you'll want to show my cousin when you get to her house, so she knows you've come from me."
"I guess she's not prone to intuitions, huh?" He smiled.
"She is, actually. And I've done my best in that regard. But it's not wise to rely on such communications. It's something you may want later on, if your mission is successful and you're able to return to your own fairy tale world."
"What is it?"
"Look in your pack sack and you'll see."
He smiled, reached out for me, and took me by the shoulders.
"You may not be the prince, Charlie, but you're a brave boy."
"Someday my prince will come," I half sang. He smiled, the wrinkles on his face flowed.
"Adrian knew that same song. He said it was from a moving picture that told a story."
"Snow White and the Seven Dwarves." Woody nodded.
"He also said the real story was much darker."
"Aren't they all?" I thought. "Thank you for everything. Take care of yourself and Catriona."
"We take care of each other. Do you remember all I told you?"
"I think so, yes."
"Most important?"
"Follow Mr. Bowditch's marks. Be quiet and be out of the city before dark. Because of the night soldiers."
"Do you believe what I told you about them, Charlie? You must. Because otherwise you might be tempted to stay too long if you haven't reached the sundial."
"You told me Hannah is a giant and the night soldiers are the undead."
"Yes, but do you believe it?"
I thought of the big cockroaches and rabbits. I thought of a red cricket almost the size of Catriona. I thought of Dora with her disappearing face and Leah with a scar for a mouth. "Yes," I said. "I believe it all."
"Good. Remember to show Claudia what I put in your pack sack."
I hoisted Radar into the cart and opened my pack. On top, gleaming mellowly in the light of another cloudy day, was a gilt fist. I looked at the door to the brick house and saw the knocker was gone. I lifted it and was surprised by its weight. "My God, Woody, is this solid gold?"
"It is. In case you feel any temptation to push past the sundial and into the treasury, remember you have this to add to whatever Adrian may have gleaned in the palace on his last visit. Fare you well, Prince Charlie. I hope you don't need to use Adrian's weapon. But if you have to, don't hesitate.